Chefs at Johnson & Wales, as well as chefs in thousands of restaurants around the globe, will tell you that the hottest name in hand-forged Japanese-style knives at an affordable price is Forged to Table. The company was founded in 2017 by Johnson & Wales alum Noah Rosen when he was still a student, dedicated to the pursuit of the perfect knife for culinary students, working chefs, and home cooks alike. His guiding motto was and is today uncompromising quality at a fair price. Though Noah is no longer a student, that motto still stands true. His flagship blade, the 8-inch Gyoto chef's knife, has developed a cult following among kitchen professionals across the country, including Matt and myself. We both love that knife. But Matt, what else are you loving from Forge to Table besides the Gyoto knife?
I think it's only appropriate, given the theme of our episode today, to talk about their 10-inch serrated bread knife, but also,
ooh, yeah,
but also throw in a little bench knife there too, because today we're talking all about bread, and no better way from start to finish to help clean your board with that razor sharp bench knife and then effortlessly slice through the perfect loaf with their 10-inch serrated bread knife.
That's a great combo. Those are both great staples for pastry chefs and regular chefs alike.
Yeah, whoa, 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 what do you mean pastry chefs?
I know, so does my husband, but I feel like pastry chefs use a serrated a little bit more than maybe a culinary chef might, but.
Interesting. No better way to slice through a super ripe tomato than with a serrated knife, though.
That's true.
All right. Anyway, so what were we talking about?
Either way you slice it, you can order your own Forged to Table knife at forgedtotable.com using our promo code for 15% off. So that's promo code culinary now at forgedtotable.com for 15% off your purchase. You can also check out some of the knives in the JWU student store on the Providence campus, but you won't get the discount. So online's the way to go. And while you're online, be sure to follow at forgedtotable on Instagram, where they share great recipes. They will keep you in the loop on new and exciting knives that they have coming out, and they even have some giveaway opportunities. Forged to Table is proud to support the development of new and aspiring cooks and chefs everywhere, and to join in the effort to create a better industry for us all, which we love.
Thanks, Forged to Table, for sponsoring this podcast. Welcome, everyone, to the Culinary Now podcast. I'm Matt Britt.
And I'm Jamie Schick.
And today on the pod, we're joined by Chef Richard Miskovich, who is a department chair, Johnson & Wales University, specializing in artisan breads. He's also the author of From the Wood-Fired Oven. Chef, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking me.
I am so excited that we get to speak with you today. We have worked together for 8 years. And I feel like when we were coming up with this episode, I realized I actually don't know what led you into the bread world. So I'm excited to dive deep into this and learn a little bit more about your history. So could you share how you got into the artisan bread world?
Sure, I'd love to. I'm going to go back a little further. I was always interested in food. My dad was a good role model because he cooked a lot. It wasn't necessarily a baking household too much, but just making food. So then I went to college at Michigan State University, where I was an English major, and I started working in a grocery store, and then they opened an in-store bakery, and I started working in that. It was a typical grocery store proof and bake bakery, but it was located across from this big international housing area, so it was a very interesting grocery store. With a lot of different imported foods. It was in Michigan, of course, so there were breads from Detroit and things like that. And so it just made me aware of the bread baking process. I got used to going to work before class, which I liked and I still like. And I just kind of got a taste of that production sense. And then I moved to California, and this would have been about 92, early 90s. And of course, the food scene was changing at that point. And I had some artisan bread where I lived in Santa Barbara. And that was a huge revelation. And then I moved to North Carolina with my ex-wife, and I had more time. I just started baking at home. And again, this is now like artisan bread world was starting to come on the scene. And so San Francisco Baking Institute had just opened. I read this book called Bread Alone by Dan Leader. There are tons of bread books now, but that was one of the first. And I just got intrigued by going from old style American baking to this European style hearth breads. So I went to SFBI and took a couple of weeks of classes, very similar to the ones that we have now in our program at Johnson & Wales. And I met Alan Scott, an oven builder, wood-fired oven builder, when I was out there. And so I learned to bake and I got exposed to these wood-fired ovens, went back to North Carolina where we had just bought some property and built an oven and started baking. Originally, it was going to be just a small backyard oven, but it got a little bigger because I figured I'm doing it, right? So just had a small little commercial enterprise for a little while. Learned a lot, pre-internet days kind of. So it was like reading a lot of books and newsletters. The Bread Bakers Guild of America started right about that time. And then it just, all these people came together in the baking world and everyone was teaching everyone else. And then I went up to King Arthur and worked there for a couple of years before I came here. So I was very fortunate. I'm a product of the changing American foodscape. And I just kind of fell into that. And there were all kinds of new ways to learn and new enthusiastic people, new supply chain or organics were starting to come on around there. So that's how I got to Johnson & Wales.
Chef, it's such an interesting story. I mean, it's like, it's weird because it's linear. Like you definitely had a progression that seems normal. Like you went from place to place learning as you went, but you were all over the world. And you said the American foodscape, you've seen bread develop, but from so many different lenses. It's probably really impacted you in a positive way. But along that journey, like, was there a loaf? Like, what was there a piece of bread that you ate that was like, boom, this is it. This is what I'm going to dedicate my life to. Or was it just something that happened incrementally over time?
I would say it was both. You know, when I lived in Santa Barbara, which was just a sophisticated city, and I had this piece of chocolate pumpernickel bread, and I just never had anything quite like that. And I was like, oh, this is like an upscale version of, but I had these iconic breads from my youth. You know, I was always interested in my Polish ancestry, and I had Polish aunts and uncles who came from Hamtramck, a Polish enclave in Detroit. So that also formed my impression. And then I also had the opportunity to work with James McGuire, who's a great baker, chef, pastry chef. He lives in Montreal. And he introduced me to a couple of basic breads like Rustique and Miche and a 67% rye, which is kind of like my power trio of breads that fulfill every niche. So things like that, naturally leavened Miche, it just is a connection to the days gone by, you know, of, you know, old European hearth breads and how flavorful they can be when you get grain to ferment in a controlled environment, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that almost speaks to your book where it's called From the Wood-Fired Oven, but it's also kind of about bringing people together around cooking, even if that is fire. And I know that you spent some time building the wood-fired ovens and helping other people do that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That was, again, when I was out in California that first time and I met this man named Alan Scott, who really kind of revitalized the wood-fired oven movement in the U.S. And that was my first kind of major oven. And it is a primal thing. It's super enjoyable. It's like what Matt said, brings people together. Or Jamie, maybe you said it, sorry. But there's fire, which is a draw, and there's food, and it's warm, and it's cozy. And you can use it to make food in a wide variety of heat, of temperature ranges, from super, super hot to really quite cool. That, because there's a lot of thermal mass, it holds that heat for a long time. So it's you can dehydrate things in there, and you can just blaze away at super high temps. So
it's experiential. Like it's definitely part of what food is today. And like you see this as far as like, you know, where food is heading. It's not just about the actual plate in front of you. It's about the experience of how that food got to the table or how it was prepared. But chef, I have to ask, because like you're in like the stratosphere, and I've had the breads you've made, like they're mind blowing, and I'm not trying to like fluff you up, but like they're really good. And
thank you.
I am not in the stratosphere. I'm actually probably like underwater, but like as a bread baker, but I love baking bread. And I think that one thing that you do really well is you're able to take this intense amount of knowledge and translate that to people that have maybe never even touched bread before. How difficult is it for you to sort of, dare I say, dumb it down a little bit, or to talk about like, just, okay, I don't have a wood-fired oven. I have a conventional oven, and I might not even have a KitchenAid mixer. Like, what do I, like, how do you approach that type of entry-level bread baker?
Yeah, it's interesting because bread's simple and complex at the same time. There are only four ingredients, but they can be in widely different ratios, and time and temperature makes a difference. But I think, you know, being able to appeal to different levels, we all have this advantage of having become professional educators, right? And you know what is ephemera, and you know what the basics are, what the foundation information that you need. And also doing it both on a commercial scale, you know, like there are steps that you might read in a home bread baking recipe methodology, but really isn't that important, right? I mean, you read all this stuff all the time. You're like, you don't really have to do that. And people who don't have that experience of making it at a larger scale, or have not had enough years of experience where they're like, whoops, I skipped that step and it made absolutely no difference. And then you kind of can amass that to simplify the variables. So that's kind of a big thing, right? And I remember learning that as when I first started really teaching, was boil it down to the essential information. And then if the audience is open to or has the capacity to get these nuances, then you can throw those in.
Speaking of your audience, you definitely have a wide audience that you teach to, because you teach to professionals, you teach to home cooks, you teach to students who are looking to go into this for a profession. Do you find that there's one common misunderstanding that a lot of people have about bread or the bread baking process, or does it tend to differ depending on the audience?
That's a great question, Jamie. I think one misconception is that it's a lot of work, which it is sometimes a little bit of work spread over a long time. There's a misconception that it has to be like completely right at each step, which we know how to adjust for variables. I would say here, you know, in an educational facility teaching young culinarians and bakers and pastry chefs, and, you know, there's a perception that you sit around waiting for the bread to rise, you know, which is really frustrating because we always know there's something to do in a commercial kitchen, whether it's something that's not fermenting, something for tomorrow, something that needs to be cleaned today, mising out for something else. So, that's part of the fun thing, I think, teaching classes at Johnson Wales is trying to get across the point that the day is a dovetailed puzzle. Whenever you have these 7 minutes, you can fit something else in there, or at least get started on something else.
I'm glad you said that, because I love eating bread, but making bread for me is not something I enjoy because it's such a long process. And I get so excited for the final product to be done, to taste it. And with bread, that process just takes a long time. There's so many steps. And then when it's out, you have to wait for it to cool. And I struggle with the patience. How do you fill that time? Like with your different classes, you talked about prepping something, cleaning something. Is that what you have your students do in those classes? Or do you go deeper into the science behind the ingredients in the bread?
It could be that. Make a production schedule, things that are going to need to ferment longer. You know, there's some logical way that the day fits together. And then sometimes, yeah, it's like we have some time for some questions. And you know, this is finishing baking, or let's give this another 10 or 15 minutes before we start baking it. And then I also think, and this again is kind of reflecting of being at Johnson Wales for 20 years and learning about teaching, is that the day doesn't have to be packed 100%. I used to think, oh my gosh, man, we got to be doing something every minute of every class period, whether it's at Johnson & Wales or if I'm teaching at King Arthur or something like that. Like, it's people paid money. Like, I got to do something. But
right.
People need time to incorporate that into their heads. They need to say, oh my gosh, there's Chef Schick. I love her Instagram page. I just want to talk to her, right? I want to network with people. And Vanilla Bean Chef on Instagram. And
oh, thank you.
And so that is another part of that bread baking class experience that I think is useful. It's just that time for people to reflect or go use the restroom or get another cup of coffee or make a quick call or something and not feel like they're missing out.
And what do you tell people when the bread comes out and they want to bite into it like me and you're like, no, 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 you have to wait. We got to let it cool a little bit. How do you prevent yourself from doing that? Because warm bread, everyone loves like fresh warm bread with like warm, melty butter. Oh, and it smells so good. How do you calm all that down to be like, no, no, we got to wait. Got to have the patience to do this right.
I just let them do it. I mean, because it's innate and nobody doesn't like that experience, right? It might not be the best, but it's not a terrible thing. And there are purists out there who they hear that, they're going to think I'm just a real Neanderthal. But, you know, if we make a lot of bread, we can try it when it's warm and you can try some once it's cool.
Oh, yes. That's great. Yeah.
But then you can also explain, like, this is why it should cool. It's not done baking inside. There's carryover baking, right? The crumb is still too tender. So when you do cut it, it's not going to be as nice as when it's cool. There's a pressure differential in bread when it comes out of the oven. So as it cools, it draws oxygen through probably a well caramelized crust. So you're filtering oxygen through caramelized crust and that flavor is being deposited inside the loaf. So that's my favorite reason, right? It's going to be better if you don't break it up, just in the same way that you want to let your turkey rest a little bit before you slice it too.
See, the way you just described that is way more intelligent than what I would say, which is you'd burn your mouth. Like, you know, it'd be just too hot. You know, the way you said it, like, sounded intelligent and like an actual, like, based in science. And I'm like, don't be a fool, it'll burn you. And like, right. But like, both of them are like true, but yours is just better.
Yeah. And it's probably, you know, there are those who say it's harder to digest and maybe it is. But the thing is, you know what? I don't know. I'm kind of like, go ahead and eat some warm bread.
Yeah.
Just go ahead and eat some warm bread. You know, make 2 loaves or 200 loaves and have the experience. If it makes you feel good.
Chef, I have a question. So you said earlier when Jamie was talking, she asked about like misconceptions and you kind of alluded to like everything doesn't have to be perfect. Like there are ways to sort of change things along the way, which I definitely agree with you on. Cause I feel like as a culinary chef, like we're pivoting every moment of every day. And we always paint a picture that baking or desserts are way more precise, but I'm glad to hear you say that. If you had to say, is there something in bread baking, knowing that everything doesn't have to be perfect, is there something that you would advise, whether it's the entry level bread baker or the more advanced bread baker, you cannot miss? And like, so I have my thing that I feel like if you leave it out or you miss it, it's going to dramatically impact the loaf in a bad way. But I'm curious what yours is before I say mine. And then Jamie, I don't know if there's something you want to, if you have one thing that you always think is important.
So controlling fermentation is the most important. And that's very broad and vague, right? Because you could do some, and it depends on ratios of water and yeast. So, and it depends on what you want to make. So whatever category of bread you're making, you have to have that fermentation period correct. And so that's time and temperature. And they're optimum fermentation temperatures of 75 to 78 or so. But you also might be able to cold ferment that. And it's not going to be 75 or 78 for a long time. It makes it very convenient. You can have something ferment for a long time under controlled circumstances and build up flavors through fermentation. So that's the thing I would say. There's that, controlling fermentation in all of its phases and all of its applications and techniques and methods. There's not one right way to do it. It just has to be controlled. And then the baking environment with the proper temperature and steam for yeast biologically leavened breads. Those are the two things that, you know, you can have perfectly fermented bread in an oven that's too low or no steam, and it's not going to look good.
See, that's so funny because like your response as like what I said earlier was way more intricate and probably from the mind of a bread baker. Like if you ask me like what you shouldn't forget, I'm just going to say don't forget salt because bread without salt sucks.
Right. But, yeah.
But I know that there are breads that use less salt, and your response is way better, because I think about when you mentioned the cold fermentation side of things, I think about like brioche or bagels and things that, that rest in under refrigeration, and how that can actually dramatically impact the quality of that particular loaf. So once again, your answer is better, but I mean, it's like,
but you have a really good answer though too. If there's no salt, and it kind of falls under the same umbrella, if you're, you know, cause salt controls enzymatic activity and yeast activity. Yeah. If you don't have salt, then you are failing to control fermentation. So, so it's one thing under that very broad dome of controlling fermentation.
And I also, you're also failing to enhance flavor, because bread without salt isn't going to have the same flavor, because salt is a flavor enhancer. Like, you both know how I feel about salt,
right?
And you really do need it to bring out the flavor of the bread.
Yeah,
and I don't want to sound like a typical culinary guy, because I know that's like probably like the most common feedback that students get, at least early on in their culinary education, is like, oh, it either needs salt or acid. And I don't want to come off being like too primal, but like, Jamie, you're right. It's, I don't know. I've had some bread, like even bread that I've made, where I've like forgotten the salt by accident. Like, it really isn't good.
No. Yeah. It's not good in a couple different ways, several different ways.
Right.
From fermentation to flavor, to dough strength, to shelf life. It's amazing that one ingredient does so much.
You've been through this amazing journey, and clearly your knowledge is just like unparalleled. What excites you now, knowing what you know and seeing where bread has come and where it potentially is heading? I know you're not a trends guy, and I'm not going to ask you to predict the future, but like, what makes you get out of bed in the morning and be like, you know what, I'm still dedicating my life to this 4-ingredient product, because of what reason?
Yeah, there are things that are happening that are exciting. And, you know, when I say I'm not a trends guy, it's kind of like, what's the color of the year, or the type of bread, or, you know, the matcha tea of the year, or whatever. But I would kind of go back to my comment on the American foodscape, and that would be like the local grain economy. And it is truly an economy that has grown out both from the agricultural aspect, that there are people out there willing to grow non-commodity wheat that's appropriate for their bioregion, the infrastructure of milling it locally, and, well, harvesting it, cleaning it, milling it, and then getting it to consumers who that's something that's sought after, and that can afford it, right? And so I'm just kind of like, what an interesting thing, and this, you know, is definitely an exciting thing, is like that grain economy has brought together other industries. And this was just pre-pandemic. I went to an organization, a conference called Northeast Grain Shed Alliance. It's still around. And that was the first conference I'd been to in a while. It wasn't all my baking brothers and sisters. They were there too, but it was brewers and distillers. And although I knew that beer and spirits were made from grain, I hadn't quite had the experience of interacting with people that were using the same grain supply as the burgeoning locally milled, grown and milled grain for baked goods and culinary applications too. You know, when you think about Dan Barber and you think about Northeast Grain Shed Alliance, you think about all these regional grain organizations that are making connections between the farmer and the processors and the consumer. And that's a huge thing. It's you know, growing up without having a country full of farmers markets, and we have that now. And without having all these different craft foods and artisan foods, we do, and each segment continues to evolve. And the grain one was a kind of hard, partly because of the infrastructure, but that just seems like it's got a pretty firm foothold and is only going to continue to grow, literally and figuratively.
That connection is really interesting when you think about it as like a food system and on a really, really big scale, which we've talked about food systems and food policy on our pod. And it's interesting when you can bring all of that to light and kind of bring it more to like a personal application.
Can I just say one thing on the end of that? Because you're saying personal application. I was just going to bring up one of the favorite projects that I worked on with Northeast Grain Shed Alliance is a calculator. It's called the Square Foot campaign. And so we created these calculators so you can put in a bread formula or a beer formula or spirits, and it will calculate how much grain was grown in a particular plot of land, like 4 square feet. It's about 4 square feet of barley to make a pint of beer.
Wow.
That's a lot. It seems like a lot, right?
When you think about, it does.
When you think about how many pints of beer there are in the world. And the idea of that was to connect it to a personal, that's what reminded me of it, Chef Schick, was there's a logo, it's on the can, and someone's picking that up and they're like, oh, this is 4 square feet of land. Just in the same way that you order off a menu and like, this, you know, duck was raised here or is wild harvested, or these mushrooms were grown on this farm and all that type of stuff that's happened in not that long of a time in the American food world. I'm sorry, I cut you off though. You were going to ask something else.
No, that was great. That's really, really interesting. Can people find that calculator online if they're just curious?
Yep. Go to Northeast Grain Shed Alliance. It's right there. You can see it. I don't think you have to be a member. I think everyone can use it. It's really fun to play around with.
Oh, all right. That'll be a fun rabbit hole to get lost in. I know we're getting towards the end of our time. I'm just curious if it's kind of a two-parter. First, my first question is, do you do a lot of baking at home? And if so, is it bread? And do you have like a go-to loaf that you make regularly and constantly that you never get sick of?
I don't bake as much at home as I would like to, but when I do, it's usually bread. And so that's just typical traditional sourdough because I'm comfortable in controlling the fermentation in a lot of different ways. So it's not like I wake up on Saturday, I'm like, oh, I have this whole 12 or 14 hours ahead of me. I'm like, well, I can start some today and I can chill it down and I can do this and I can do that. And so it is very satisfying. I love doing it. I think my culinary friends know I'm really interested in cooking too. And I love the freedom that comes from cooking. You know, like being, we weigh ingredients and using water temperature formula and do all these things, control time and temperature, worry about, is it going to over ferment if I leave it on my porch tonight, or should I bring it in? All that type of stuff, which is fun. But on the other hand, man, I love cooking and just like putting things together and, you know, not
it's freeing.
Not being confined by a methodology. During the pandemic, I got into a big meatloaf phase in the beginning. And I was like, I first started looking up, like, I'm not going to look up some meatloaf recipes. And I'm like, what the heck? I could make a damn meatloaf, you know, and I'm not going to read anything about making meatloaf. I mean, why should I have to? But you know what I mean, right? I'm making soup today.
Yeah.
It's what's in my fridge.
You know, that's so funny, because if you asked any other person on the planet what they got into during the pandemic, it would be bread. Except for you. You got into meatloaf. Well, maybe not Jamie, because she's shaking her head no, but like, I just went skiing last week and like I was riding the lift and they're like, oh yeah, we really got into bread over the pandemic. It's like, I feel like you hear that all the time.
Oh yeah. But yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing.
But you got into meatloaf. And just think that's the music anyway.
I occasionally played Bat Out of Hell when I was making some meatloaf.
I was going to say, because like, all right, well, we'll get it. So Chef, so, I mean, again, you talk a lot about like the fermentation side, like I'm sure like at your house, like you have a starter. And my question to you is, and this is sort of cheeky, what's the name?
I don't name starters for some reason. I never did. I do love naming things, right? I love naming parts of my yard and I love naming pets and things like that. But for some reason, I never was drawn to that. Although I think it's great and people do it, you know, I'm not being judgmental. I don't ever do it. Partly because it's become, you know, we exchange them, you know, it doesn't have an origin story where I'm like, this was Jesus's sourdough starter or anything like that. But when people do name them, which is common, I always remind them that I think it should be a female name because it is a giver of life, right? It multiplies. You just have to feed it, like all of us really. But if you do in the right conditions, it goes and creates something completely different, which is we have these sayings and idioms, right? A woman's pregnant, there's a bun in the oven. And so I just always feel like starters are female entities. So if I was to name it, it would be something beautiful like Eleanor or something.
That's really interesting. I have a question about starters, though. People always say, I've had this starter for 30 years, and that's why my bread is so good. I have my own thoughts on that. Do you actually think that someone who's had their starter for a long period of time, do you think that's actually influencing the end product, the flavor of the bread?
No, what's more important, I don't believe that at all. I believe what is important is that how it's maintained and cared for, especially in the recent past. And so this is something I heard from my friend Noah Elbers from Orchard Hill Breadworks in New Hampshire. He's like, it doesn't really matter who your grandparents are. It does, kind of, genetics and all that type of stuff. But what's more important is that, are you a healthy person? Did you just have good nutrition for the past couple of weeks? You know, if I had a 30-year-old starter that wasn't fed for a couple of weeks and I used it, it wouldn't be very, you wouldn't have as good of results as if that was maintained. So that's being turned over all the time with new flour. And it might become stable, but I'm not convinced there's an inherent value of having some little microcosm of that starter having been around for 30 years.
That goes with what I feel too, because I feel like because you pull some out, you feed it, and by that many years later, how much of the original starter is still in that strain that you're using? So I'm glad you said that.
Probably none. Probably none. It's been completely turned over. So.
Yeah.
Chef, this was so informative and just powerful. I think that you said things in such a way that really, you know, it transcends bread baking, which I think is sort of your ethos. You take it very seriously, and I think that that's something that anyone who wants to get more into it should do. So I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom with us. I had another question. It was unrelated to bread, but I don't want to get you upset. But do you think Den & Company should make new music?
No. And anyone who's listening who's unaware, Den & Company is one of the iterations of Grateful Dead, which Chef Britt and I are fans of.
We're actually calling this episode The Grateful Dead.
And I'm thrilled about that. Thrilled about that. And so all good things in all good time, right? And so there are some really wonderful, many wonderful long parts of the Grateful Dead history that are great. And I went to Dead & Co. shows in the beginning, and it was like so thrilling to be back in that scene. So you get a little choked up, you know, because it's such a wonderful group of people, just like bakers. It reminds me of when I first learned met bakers, like, these are my people. And and then it just kind of like some things pass, right? Some people don't leave the party quite on time, and I think it's time for that. It's nothing against any of those musicians, and I think they all have their own side things that they can do, and that's great. It's just, I think if they detached from the Dead part, still do that music, but just have it be in a completely different entity, that would be better. If it was still kind of cranking on and really kind of more of my style, I would want it to keep going. How about you? What do you think?
I would probably, there's a part of me that would like just like, I don't know. Like I never saw like the Jerry Dead. Uh-huh. So I don't have that experience personally. So there's a part of me that's like give John and Bob a little bit of time and maybe they could come up with something really fun. But then I would also be crucified by some really hardcore people that would be like, you know, it had its moment and it's no longer what it was. But yeah. I mean, I do enjoy listening to them, and for what it's worth, anyone who has attended one of their shows or watched them, I mean, Bob Weir is amazing at his age doing what he's
totally,
doing.
Totally, you know, and it just,
but it's changed.
You know, it's a little slower. That's part of it. And that's fine. And, you know, I hope that I can be as active as Bob Weir is when I'm his age, you know, and I'm grateful for all of that. It's just kind of not to my liking. I'm not as thrilled about it now as, you know, in 2017 or definitely like 87.
But I random non-bread related question, but I had to like do it because we are going to, well, Jamie doesn't know this, but I am calling this episode The Grateful Bread. So
I think you slipped with that. And again, I'm thrilled. This is my kind of professional development.
There it is. There it is. Yeah, I'll sign off on this if you need like a witness that you did it. All right. Well, Chef, thank you again for taking the time for sharing the stories. Honestly, we're so honored to have you here and be able to talk with you.
No. Well, I'm so honored that you asked me, and you know, I know you both have so much knowledge and charisma and, you know, just different spheres of the food world. So I'm really honored that you asked me. So thanks very much.
Thank you. thank you again to Richard Miskovich for joining us on today's pod and sharing all of his bread knowledge with us. If you like this episode or any of our other episodes, please leave us a rating and review. We really appreciate it.
And thanks also to Matt Burns, who does all the music for the podcast. And if you want to get in touch with us, we love to hear from you, to hear your feedback, potential episode ideas. If there's someone you feel like we should speak to, reach out to us at culinarynowpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Instagram or Facebook or other social sites at Culinary Now Podcast. We will talk to you soon.